Chapter 33. Carried in his hand, and forbade the battle. The Duke of Hereford was to be banished for 10 years, and the Duke of Norfolk was to be banished for life. So said the king. The Duke of Hereford went to France, and went no farther. The Duke of Norfolk made a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, and afterwards died at Venice of a broken heart. Faster and fiercer, after this, the king went on in his career. The Duke of Lancaster, who was the father of the Duke of Hereford, died soon after the departure of his son, and the king, although he had solemnly granted to that son leave to inherit his father's property, if it should come to him during his banishment, immediately seized it all, like a robber. The judges were so afraid of him, that they disgraced themselves, by declaring this theft to be just and lawful. His avarice knew no bounds. He outlawed 17 counties at once, on a frivolous pretense, merely to raise money by way of fines for misconduct. In short, he did as many dishonest things as he could, and cared so little for the discontent of his subjects, though even the spaniel favorites began to whisper to him that there was such a thing as discontent afloat, that he took that time, of all others, for leaving England and making an expedition against the Irish. He was scarcely gone, leaving the Duke of York regent in his absence, when his cousin, Henry of Hereford, came over from France, to claim the rights of which he had been so monstrously deprived. He was immediately joined by the two great earls of Northumberland and Westmoreland, and his uncle, the regent, finding the king's cause unpopular, and the disinclination of the army to act against Henry very strong, withdrew with the royal forces towards Bristol. Henry, at the head of an army, came from Yorkshire where he had landed, to London and followed him. They joined their forces. How they brought that about is not distinctly understood, and proceeded to Bristol Castle, whither three noblemen had taken the young queen. The castle surrendering, they presently put those three noblemen to death. The regent then remained there, and Henry went on to Chester. All this time, the boisterous weather had prevented the king from receiving intelligence of what had occurred. At length it was conveyed to him in Ireland, and he sent over the Earl of Salisbury, who, landing at Conway, rallied the Welshmen, and waited for the king a whole fortnight. At the end of that time the Welshmen, who were perhaps not very warm for him in the beginning, quite cooled down and went home. When the king did land on the coast at last, he came with a pretty good power, but his men cared nothing for him, and quickly deserted. Supposing the Welshman to be still at Conway, he disguised himself as a priest, and made for that place in company with his two brothers, and some few of their adherents. But there were no Welshmen left, only Salisbury and 100 soldiers. In this distress, the king's two brothers, Exeter and Surrey, offered to go to Henry, to learn what his intentions were. Surrey, who was true to Richard, was put into prison. Exeter, who was false, took the royal badge, which was a heart, off his shield, and assumed the rose, the badge of Henry. After this, it was pretty plain to the king what Henry's intentions were, without sending any more messengers to ask. The fallen king, thus deserted, hemmed in on all sides, and pressed with hunger, rode here and rode there, and went to this castle, and went to that castle, endeavoring to obtain some provisions, but could find none. He rode wretchedly back to Conway, and there surrendered himself to the Earl of Northumberland, who came from Henry, in reality to take him prisoner, but in appearance to offer terms, and whose men were hidden not far off. By this earl he was conducted to the castle of Flint, where his cousin Henry met him, and dropped on his knee, as if he were still respectful to his sovereign. "Fair cousin of Lancaster," apostrophe said the king, "you are very welcome, no doubt, but he would have been more so, in chains or without a head." "My lord," apostrophe replied Henry, "I am come a little before my time, But, with your good pleasure, I will show you the reason. Your people complain with some bitterness that you have ruled them rigorously for 22 years. Now, if it please God, I will help you to govern them better in future. Apostrophe, fair cousin, apostrophe reply to the abject king, since it pleaseth you, it pleaseth me mightily. Apostrophe, after this, the trumpet sounded, and the king was stuck on a wretched horse, and carried prisoner to Chester, where he was made to issue a proclamation, calling a parliament. From Chester he was taken on towards London. At Lichfield he tried to escape, by getting out of a window and letting himself down into a garden. It was all in vain, however, and he was carried on and shut up in the Tower, where no one pitied him, and where the whole people, whose patience he had quite tired out, reproached him without mercy. Before he got there, it is related, that his very dog left him, and departed from his side, to lick the hand of Henry. The day before the Parliament met, a deputation went to this wrecked king, and told him that he had promised the Earl of Northumberland at Conway Castle to resign the crown. He said he was quite ready to do it, and signed a paper in which he renounced his authority, and absolved his people from their allegiance to him. He had so little spirit left, that he gave his royal ring to his triumphant cousin Henry with his own hand, and said, that if he could have had leave to appoint a successor, that same Henry was the man of all others whom he would have named. Next day, the Parliament assembled in Westminster Hall, where Henry sat at the side of the throne, which was empty, and covered with a cloth of gold. The paper just signed by the king was read to the multitude amid shouts of joy, which were echoed through all the streets. When some of the noise had died away, the king was formally deposed. Then Henry arose, and, making the sign of the cross on his forehead and breast, challenged the realm of England as his right. The archbishops of Canterbury and York seated him on the throne. The multitude shouted again, and the shouts re-echoed throughout all the streets. No one remembered, now, that Richard II had ever been the most beautiful, the wisest, and the best of princes, and he now made living, to my thinking, a far more sorry spectacle in the Tower of London, than what Tyler had made, lying dead, among the hoofs of the royal horses in Smithfield. The poll tax died with Watt. The Smiths to the king and royal family could make no chains in which the king could hang the people's recollection of him, so the poll tax was never collected. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.